I don't think any sample provider is trying to like proactively provide you with bad users. That would be a very sort of bad business model. But I also think that the internet is a very messy place. And so it starts with having those transparent conversations and really partnering as a client and supplier or suppliers to really attack this at a more holistic level.
This is Real Talk, the Customer Insights Show with Jen Vogel, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen on all major podcast channels. Join Jen and her guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by Vox PopMe, the leader in video research and ranked number one in qualitative research by Grit 2 years running. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and everyone who wants to understand their customers better. I'm your host, Jen Vogel. Data quality matters in research, but how do we ensure our data is of high quality? What does that even mean? This is a big one. To dive into this topic, I'm joined by Lisa Wilding Brown, CEO at InnovateMR and an SMR Council member for now. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Hi, Jen. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's so good to see you.
So good to see you also. What have you been up to lately? You've got some big things happening.
Yes. There's a lot of exciting things going on in my world. So I am running for re-election for the SMR Council. I've been on council for the last 2 years, and voting is open right now. In fact, voting closes tomorrow. So for those that are procrastinating, you have very little time left to submit your votes, but please, you know, exercise your right to vote. And if you are a current member of SMR, you should have received an email to do so a couple weeks back. So you can go ahead and submit your votes. And then the announcement will be made on November 3rd on who will be the new council to take us forward for the next term. So really, really looking forward. I've been going on a few different podcasts over the last couple of weeks and just sharing what I've been up to. I've been really involved in the council for the last couple of years. And the way that the council works, when the council first comes on board, the president will really set the agenda, working very closely in collaboration with the other council members. And so there were several different steering committees that surfaced when our term got together. And I put my hat in the ring for a few different steering committees. One is the Young SMR Society, which is an initiative that I hold very near and dear to my heart. It's for young researchers, people that are newer to the profession under the age of 30. And the initiative is really designed to pair those individuals with more established people in the space and certainly give them opportunities for different webinars, community circles, and networking opportunities for them to just get more established in the industry and make a quicker impact. And then I've also been very involved in the DEI steering committee, which has really been focused on expanding the industry's efforts around representation and equity. And so there's been a series of community circles. And most recently at SMR Congress, we announced a new repository, a library of sorts, that brings together all the great thinking and content that various associations and different collectives and consortiums have put out there, so that we really have a nice resource for our members that, you know, is vetted and really representative of all the great work that's being done on DEI across the world. So those are just a couple examples of the different steering committees that I've been on, Jen, but excited to make an impact on data quality as well, which is something that was a hot topic at Congress, and I'm sure will continue to be a really important topic at the different conferences and shows that are coming up this season.
Yeah, absolutely. And those committees that you mentioned are so critical also, and that effort to kind of bring together all the learnings from different orgs and different associations, I think is like so needed right now, because right now there are a lot of disparate resources out there and having a central repository is so important. So, well, good luck in the elections. just quickly, like, how can people vote if they don't already know how to access the voting?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've had even like my mom reached out to me. She's like, can I vote? No, you can't vote, Mom. You have to be a member of SMR. And certainly if you're not a member, it's probably a little bit too late to get in on the action, but I would still encourage folks that are thinking about it or on the fence to get involved. SMR is just a wonderful, wonderful organization. It's really the only global organization that, you know, is 75 years old. So we've been around a really long time. And there's just so much wonderful content, research on research, great networking opportunities. But if you are a member, you would have received an email. So make sure you check your spam folder or your junk folder to make sure it didn't get accidentally, you know, siphoned there. But it's just a simple link. You can put your votes in virtually through a third party that SMR hired to make sure that, you know, there's independent review of that. But you can submit your votes through that link that you would have received as a member. And then it gets announced on November 3rd. So it's right around the corner, Jen.
Awesome. Well, good luck to you. I'm glad we were able to get you on the show right before the voting closes tomorrow. So thanks for coming on. And so let's dive into data quality a little bit. This is one of your specialties. Why is this such an important thing to focus on for you?
Yeah, well, our work is never done, Jen. You know, data quality is not a new challenge that the industry has been facing, but it is becoming more and more complex and more sophisticated. In my mind, and I've said this before, but I'll say it again, I think it's important to think about data quality on a spectrum. On one end, you have those really nefarious users that are doing this at scale, that are really trying to exploit vulnerabilities of you know, research agencies, of panel companies, and find out where those sort of vulnerabilities exist and then, you know, really attack them. So they're really sophisticated. They're leveraging great technical prowess to get their work done. But that's not just the one use case, right? And in the middle of the spectrum, you have real human beings, but they might be being recruited from, say, you know, over-incentivized websites where, you know, users are really focused on that sort of instant gratification, and they maybe aren't taking your survey as seriously as you are. So they have a tendency to be very top two box, hyper aware, hyper satisfied, or it may just demonstrate signs of fatigue. If your survey is especially long, they may fatigue out and just really not participate and behave in the way that you expect them to. So that's another use case that, you know, solutions need to be employed to really catch. And then on the other far end, you have more kind of innocent issues that pop up as it relates to data quality. And that just is a result of a lot of the multi-vendor usage that's going on in the space today and the natural duplication that can exist from panel source or sample source to sample source. So there's a lot of different permutations, but the good news, Jen, is there's a lot of strategies that you can employ to really get ahead of it and try to be as proactive as you possibly can. But again, you know, I think the main headline here, Jen, is that cyber fraud has continued to increase. And that's not unusual. Anytime there's some sort of economic duress, you know, whether it's a conflict or a pandemic, that can really invite those folks that live in, say, more developing regions of the world to leverage those sophisticated tools and techniques that they are well versed in to really figure out a way to get into these surveys and operate at scale for the incentives that are offered. They typically will target lower incidence populations because they know that you know, those surveys typically will offer a higher incentive. And they also very much often will focus on B2B projects where, again, that incentive is quite a handsome offering. So they can really, you know, build up that incentive at a very quick pace.
Yeah. And as they get more sophisticated, like you see it happening as there's new technology that gets put in place to protect surveys from this type of fraud, there are more sophisticated ways of getting around it. And it's like constantly kind of chasing our tails to be able to overcome some of these, some of these challenges, because they are just getting smarter and smarter.
They really are. They're getting so sophisticated, and the things that they did yesterday are not the things that they're doing today. The things they're doing today are not the things that they're going to be doing in the future. So they're really dynamic, and they're changing their strategies very frequently. And that can make it very difficult for companies to get ahead of. And I think too, you know, we have to sort of step back and say to ourselves, we're not going to fix cyber fraud. Cyber fraud's not going away. It's challenging multi-billion dollar brands, government agencies. If you were to measure the GDP output of cyber fraud on a global basis, it would be the third largest. And you were sort of calculated as a country in terms of costs. It would be the third largest country after the US and China. So sort of like put that into perspective in terms of just the global damages that these fraudsters are able to employ and impact on businesses, large and small. And it's a pretty scary landscape for sure.
Yeah. That's really scary when you put it that way. Like, yeah. I don't want to think about it that way. I think most of us probably don't want to think about it that way, but it's so important to address it. And so with that in mind, that, you know, it's not going away, we're not going to be able to stop this from happening entirely. Like, what is data quality in research?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think I don't want to just the mic here and make everyone instant victims. There is actually a lot that you can do on your side. And I think it starts with who you partner with and really making sure you're putting your suppliers through their paces, asking them, you know, what they're doing to source high quality sample. You know, and there's great resources. So SMR, for example, has an online buying guide for folks that buy sample online. And it's a series of questions. It's actually an expanded view of what was the original document known as the SMR 28. You know, there's several new questions that have been added in that will really help, I think, buyers of sample scrutinize the different types of suppliers and vendors and look at how they're recruiting, how they're incentivizing those users and really, you know, facilitating the sample procurement process. I think that's number one. That's super key. But sample providers, large and small, all of them have experienced and have been hit with cyber fraud. Anyone that says that they haven't is being completely disingenuous, in my opinion, Jen. And so, you know, it is in a constant evolving situation. And what it really requires is a lot of rigor, a lot of dedication. So making sure there's people on staff that are dedicated to fraud, dedicated to quality, and making sure that all those mitigation tactics are employed. And really, it's a balance between both technological strategies like digital fingerprinting, mobile verification, third-party validation on address, things like that. But there's also methodological strategies that you can employ both pre, during, and post-survey to really, again, scrutinize. So looking for things like speeding and gibberish, looking at open-end responses and evaluating them through, you know, AI or NLP projects that are products that might exist out there to really scrutinize the quality of responses. You don't have to sort of be this passive individual and just hope and pray that you get good sample. I think it really is about being proactive and recognizing that there's lots and lots of layers that you can employ, and you shouldn't just sort of put your stake in the ground and say, okay, I've done digital fingerprinting, I'm sorted. Because what we found in our testing is that digital fingerprinting is definitely a great solution, but it has a tendency to only catch those fraudsters that aren't employing the most sophisticated strategies. You really need to take it to the next level and look at things more holistically, using a lot of different tools and strategies to catch those individuals, because it's just much more nebulous to catch.
Right. Yeah, that's such a great tip, to kind of have a lot of different strategies that you're kind of working on at once. I mean, what do you think about, you know, you mentioned like natural language processing, AI can kind of help to evaluate survey response. Years ago, before that was really a thing, maybe it was more of a buzzword, there was a lot of like putting in red herring questions and things like that. Like, how do you think about balancing that sort of tactic with controlling survey length and survey fatigue, as you mentioned? Like, you know, is that sort of, that practice sort of gone away and now we're doing kind of more automated techniques?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great question. So I still believe in red herrings wholeheartedly. I may be a bit old school that way, but the thing about red herrings is they can really be used to test domain expertise. So let's say you're going after, you know, IT decision makers, rather than present them a really basic question or group of questions, really create questions and randomize those, create a battery of questions so that each user gets a different question or a different kind of scenario or combination of questions, so that you're trying to be as unpredictable as the fraudsters are in that case. Mm-hmm. But really create questions that are designed to test their domain expertise. So if you're looking for folks that have decision-making authority on CRM technology, don't just ask them what color is the sky. Siri is a bot on my iPhone. She's super smart. She can even be programmed to kind of like joke with you if you ask her funny questions. Mm-hmm. So bots nowadays are so much more sophisticated than they were when I first started in the industry, you know, about 20 years ago. Rather than rely on those sort of basic red herrings, make sure you're really designing questions. Like in this IT pro example, you know, if you're looking for CRM technology decision makers, include a question around CRM tech, include real brands like HubSpot or LinkedIn or Salesforce, and then include fake brand names. And if they have awareness on those fake brands, then you know that they're not in it for the right reasons and they're being disingenuous. So that's like a really great strategy. But, you know, I do think there's a lot of great tools out there that you kind of touched on with natural language processing. So we actually have a text analyzer in-house that we built for ourselves and then later productized for our clients because we saw the value in it. And what it does, it looks at open-end responses in real time. It assesses for things like gibberish and profanity and duplication and speeding, but it also is programmed to measure context. So we can see if the response that the respondent puts in is actually contextual to the question that was presented. And that question changes on a user by user basis. So it's drawing from a very large library of questions. And then there's other tools out there like Sentry, which is a tool that came on the market earlier this year by a company called Cloud Research. And we partnered with them because we saw that, you know, fraud was continuing to become more and more dynamic. And I think the conflict in the Ukraine has definitely caused an impact for the industry in Q1. When it came to quality and fraudulent attempts to our space. And that tool really looks not only at the responses, but it looks at the behavior and it really kind of behaviorally assesses the respondent in a way that, say, digital fingerprinting doesn't do. That really just determines if the user is using a unique device. And we know from our testing that it's really easy for the most part to actually spoof and almost digitally hijack. We call it parasitic fraud, where a user will leverage someone else's machine and take action from one centralized machine, but borrow other people's digital fingerprint to appear unique when in fact they're not.
So now I'm having a little bit more confidence in our ability to combat this cyber fraud. A few minutes ago, I was terrified with what you were talking about, but you know, there are some really great tools and techniques out there to be able to get closer to the kind of data that we need to make important decisions. Because, you know, to your point, if you're using this data for these massive product decisions, brand decisions, ensuring that it's of high quality is really important.
Yeah. And quality isn't just about the sample that's coming into the survey. A lot of it starts with the design of the survey. So I don't want to underestimate the importance of great design, not only to produce a better participant experience and reduce the effects of things like fatigue and longer surveys, but really to get that cooperation and that engagement and also to get that representation. So, you know, I've been very passionate and active in DEI, not only for my work in SMR, but also as a co-founder of the Multicultural Insights Collective, which essentially is like a consortium of different industry veterans who are really passionate about this topic and working closely with brands and other agencies to help them think about how they're approaching their efforts around DEI, both internally and externally, and helping them really facilitate better conversations with their clients and their stakeholders around those efforts. And so when we think about survey design and making sure that you've got great quality, it isn't just about, you know, mitigating the risks of cyber fraud, but it's also about making sure you have really, really great representation. So ensuring that your survey is mobile friendly is very, very important. And I can't believe I'm still saying this in 2022. But I'm still seeing a lot of desktop-only surveys. We got to get rid of that. We got to be, you know, really a mobile-first strategy, I think, is important because that's where participants are. If you look at any different panel company or sample company, all of them will report the same thing, that upwards of 60 to 70% of their traffic is coming from a mobile device. So when you exclude mobile users because your survey is only desktop-friendly, then you're automatically sort of starting off on your back foot in terms of feasibility and reach, and also excluding key cohorts that we know have a tendency to come into surveys through their mobile device, like younger generations and certain diverse cohorts that have a propensity to be more heavy in terms of using mobile versus desktop. So really making sure that you are getting a good readable base, You're oversampling diverse cohorts to ensure that they have a voice at the table. That's also key for quality as well, Jen.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And right now, especially where, you know, it's not the same as it used to be when it comes to survey taking, where, you know, somebody was calling you on the phone and you were like honored to be asked your opinion. Now people don't participate in surveys in the same way that they used to. So to exclude whole groups, whether it's mobile or, you know, some underrepresented group, is missing out massively on a portion of the population that's so key to get those insights from, especially when, you know, just respondents are limited. You know, you're never going to get everybody in the US to take your survey, nor do you want to, but to ensure that it's a good representation of the population is key.
Yeah. And it can't just be you and I worried about this. Like, we all collectively as an industry have to focus on it. And I've likened participants to the polar ice caps in the past, and I'm going to do it again now. Once they're gone, they're gone. And so I think we all have this collective responsibility to make sure that we're designing really great survey instruments that are representative and inclusive and, you know, really are in as engaging as possible. I have some clients that will never send me a survey longer than 10 minutes to help fill in terms of sample. And then I have other clients that are still struggling on that front for a number of reasons, you know, but I think we have to keep talking about those challenges because it can be very challenging in the moment. And there's an opportunity to educate folks that maybe aren't as well versed to the topic as you and I may be.
Sure. You know, another thing too is just, I mean, as we're talking about design, not just who you're inviting to the survey and making sure it's accessible to everyone, but even just question wording. And I think maybe this is coming up more now as the conversation of democratizing research expands and there's more people involved in research than maybe previously, which I think is a great thing. Any movement to bring brands closer to their consumers, whether they're in Insights role or not, is a good thing. But when it comes to question wording, I mean, as you were talking about that spectrum of data quality and, you know, that sort of innocent, like, I didn't really realize I wasn't saying the right thing or wasn't responding truthfully. A lot of it, that's well within our control and how we write our screeners or how we write the questions to not lead people down any path or the wrong path to get the right results, right? So, you know, that's just been a topic that we've been talking to our customers about a lot lately. And we've got some resources out there of like how to write a good screener question, right? But that's so key too.
Oh, 100%. I mean, when I first started in the industry, I had the privilege of starting at Harris Interactive, and they brought all of their new employees through very intensive training around questionnaire developments and had pretty rigorous standards. And I feel very lucky that I got that education. And I know nowadays there is so much democratization and disintermediation as well. So there's people that are now having to write questionnaires that maybe they would have delegated to an MR agency in the past. And so they're kind of left to their own devices and they don't know what they don't know. But the good news, Jen, I think, like you've touched on, is there's a lot of great literature online. There's wonderful resources and webinars and research on research. In fact, we've been very involved with the Global Research Business Network, the GRBN, which the managing director is Andrew Cannon. In fact, I'm presenting with him and a couple other folks at the CRC this week on Wednesday afternoon on consumer trust and what you can do to earn consumer trust. And it starts with writing really good surveys. And so the GRBN has been instrumental. They've put together a handbook a few years back based on, you know, do's and don'ts of questionnaire design based on that research on research, and refresh that handbook every couple of years. And so it's a wonderful resource. And I would definitely recommend those that are greener in the space or those that need that sort of support around questionnaire design, use those resources through the GRBN, through the Insights Association, through SMR, through the MRS. There's just so many great organizations in our industry that can really help shore up any kind of design deficit that you might be facing.
Yeah. Well, I hope to see everybody at CRC this week. I'm excited for that session especially. But that, I think, is very closely linked with data quality, like consumer trust. Like, any other hints you can give us about that session? Or,
well, you know, I think one of the things that's always sort of intrigued me about data quality is, you know, in a perfect world, you would collect loads of private, you know, personally identifiable information from participants so that you have more details to then verify their identity. But at the same time, there's all this concern around consumer privacy. And the thing is it's not just our industry, right? There's sort of this kind of halo effect that can happen when other industries that aren't even connected to us do bad things or report a data breach, right? That can erode the trust of our consumers in survey research. So that's the thing, something that maybe not everyone appreciates, is that there's these other industries, these other verticals like ad tech and social media and advertising that can sometimes have a ripple effect or an impact on our space. And so it's not always clear to participants that, okay, this is research, this is different than, say, you know, participating on social media where my information might be monetized further to like serve ads to me. And so, you know, just because we think we are an exception, I don't necessarily think consumers share that belief. And so we have to look at life and look at our work through that lens. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I think some of it just has to do with communication. You know, how are we communicating? Like, this is what we're doing. This is what you're opting in for and what we're going to use your data for. And the fact that it is private and that it is, you know, there isn't any PII associated with it. I mean, those are all things that I know the industry has worked really hard, especially over the last, I don't know, 5 years or so with GDPR and all the other sort of regulations, just making sure that we're compliant. And I think as an industry, like, you're right, like, we feel like we've done a good job, but then communicating that effectively with consumers is, you know, maybe a bit of a missing link sometimes.
Yeah.
Something we should be more conscious of.
Yep. I think we make dangerous assumptions. And I would say, you know, we have to eat our own dog food, like, test your surveys, take them yourself after you design them and see what the experience is like. And if you're struggling to get through it, or your, you know, colleagues are struggling to get through it, then maybe, you know, take another second look at it and figure out, what can you edit further? How would you as a consumer react to a survey instrument like that? So that's something that I think is not always employed by folks, and it's certainly something very important to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these are great tips, you know, sort of how to think about our survey design and our methodology, then some of the more sophisticated tools to use to ensure better data quality. Anything else that you recommend to, you know, just make sure that you've got the right quality data in your surveys?
Well, I think it's just, I think it's important to be really transparent and have open communication. And, you know, if you're new to sort of the quality landscape, just recognize that it's complex. And I don't think any sample provider is trying to, like, proactively provide you with bad users. That would be a very sort of bad business model. But I also think that the internet is a very messy place. And so it starts with having those transparent conversations and really partnering as a client and supplier or suppliers to really attack this at a more holistic level. And so, you know, if I get, you know, voted back into SMR Council, I think we really need to take things to the next level and work together with SMR and other regional associations like the Insights Association, like the MRS, and have a collected sort of approach to try to influence policymakers to hold these mega platforms that really help to facilitate a lot of the fraud that occurs, hold them accountable. So, like, when we were at SMR Congress, Innovate MR presented some pretty jaw-dropping videos of real fraudsters who were sharing their tactics and strategies. And one user in particular was on a major streaming platform helping to educate other wannabe fraudsters on the techniques that work best for him and where the vulnerabilities are. And I just think that's really helping him to scale his efforts, monetize his expertise, and promote these criminal activities online. And so rather than us as an industry reacting to those users and those people with nefarious intentions, let's try to influence policy so that it's not acceptable and it's not permitted to be able to use those big platforms to spread this this bad behavior. Let's try to get to the root cause and the source. I think that's something that I'd like to see the industry really be very proactive on moving forward. Take it to the next level.
Yeah. Those interviews at Congress were very like jaw-dropping. And correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like I've now since Congress seen them floating around the internet. Yes. So you can access them.
You can. They're on Innovate MR's YouTube channel. So definitely head over there and you can see exactly what types of examples and tips and tricks these fraudsters are employing, and just will give you kind of a closer front row seat to really what takes place.
Yeah, for sure. It was very interesting to watch and to kind of see them interviewed like face to face. Really, really interesting. So everybody go check that out. But, you know, I'm wondering, like, I mean, you and I have both been in the industry a long time. This has always sort of been a topic of conversation, but I still get the sense that we're not talking about it enough. Do you feel that way too?
I do. Sometimes I feel like it's a bit of a lonely place. I think it's gotten better, Jen, over the last, I'd say since the pandemic hit, I think people are talking more and more about it. I mean, it's no secret when the pandemic hit, and again, anytime there's sort of economic duress and struggle, it really motivates people to find alternative and creative methods to subsidize their income. And so the industry saw a major uptick. In fact, two different digital fingerprinting companies that we're partnered with both reported over a 200% increase in fraudulent activity within their ecosystem. So very large footprint of suppliers, buyers and sellers of sample coming together using those types of tools. And both companies reported well over 200% for the industry in terms of fraudulent activity at the start of the pandemic. So I think that really helped to, you know, precipitate more conversation. And certainly lots of virtual webinars came about and surfaced during the pandemic when we were all sort of working from home and continue to do so. But it's not a new issue. It's certainly not. I remember talking about it, you know, in 03, 04, when we'd be looking at survey data and seeing all these bots hitting the surveys. But the thing that's changed, Jen, is back then when bots would hit, you'd be able to discern them very easily because they would all complete the survey in less than a minute. They would all be very patterned in their responses. Whereas nowadays, bots, just like NLP has become advanced in scrutinizing open-end text, the bots have gotten more advanced. And so they're much more humanistic in nature. They're programmed to be varied. So each case that comes in is different from the next and the last. They're putting in real open-end responses. Most of the time, the bots just don't have the context, you know, nailed down quite right. So the open ends are really helpful in assessing and really qualifying fraud or sort of ruling people out or ruling them in. But it really does require, I think, lots and lots of layers and the recognition that things are becoming more advanced and more mature. Just like online research as a methodology has matured, so have the fraudsters. And so we need to level up and you know, really employ more sophisticated strategies and tools to catch them.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it's good to hear you feel like the conversation is kind of picked up a little bit. I think people are afraid, right, to talk about or to acknowledge maybe some of the data quality issues that might be out there because we want to trust in the survey results. And it does take extra thought and effort and time to be worried about this stuff. And so that's hard. It's hard to balance the two, the urgency and the lack of resources with the need to make sure it's really good quality. So it's good that we're kind of getting there, right?
I mean, there's always going to be dissonance in data for sure. I mean, that's part and parcel to our work as researchers, but, you know, keeping that at a very kind of low percentage of noise in your data set is super key. And so while there's all these great technologies, I still think there's a role for real human beings, researchers to scrutinize and put in traps and assess, you know, each user that comes into the survey instrument itself to really make sure that you're doing adequate cleaning and netting out with a great, full, robust, high quality data set at the end, where you then are using that data set to inform your client of the insights that surface during the research. So all is not lost here, Jen. It's just having these open conversations, being transparent, putting in lots of layers will really position you in a great place to maintain the trust that you're looking to build and to earn from your stakeholders.
Yeah, amazing. Now, you mentioned your work with the Young SMR Society and that kind of part of your time at SMR Council. What do you think the role of like a newer kind of fresh viewpoint on the industry can have on data quality issues?
Oh, you know, I think there's just so much opportunity. And I think a lot of times, Jen, what happens is when you're new to the industry, you feel like you just don't have the agency or that you're not credentialed to sort of have a point of view. And I think that that is 100% wrong. I think everyone, no matter where you come in from the industry, what your level of expertise is, you have a unique and fresh lens that you're looking at life and business through. And so we've really tried to encourage those younger, more greener folks to our industry to share their perspective, because there's a lot to learn. Like even as a CEO, you know, one of the concepts that we've talked about with, you know, my other colleagues on council is this notion of reverse mentoring. So even though I am, you know, in the industry 20 years and I mentor a lot of people and work closely with my team, there's an opportunity for me to learn from these younger folks. I sound like I'm really aging myself, but, you know, I really think that they can share a unique perspective that, you know, others that are more established just maybe aren't drawing from. And I think as well that we're trying to really attract diversity on a lot of different fronts, and diversity in skill set and expertise, and even coming from other industries into our industry, there's just nothing but benefit that I can see surfacing from that type of engagement and that dynamic. So we should really encourage that. So it's exciting. I love working with folks that are new to the space, because I just think back to when I first started and there weren't any sort of formal mentorship programs. Instead, it was me kind of like eyeing people I really admired and respected in the organizations that I worked at and just trying to like latch onto them and learn from them. But the good news is now there's just so many formalized mentorship programs. So young people just have no excuse, like get involved and you'll just get so much more benefit from it. And your companies will see the benefit of that involvement too. So everyone wins.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You're kind of taking me back a little bit. Like I wish there were some of those mentorship programs when I first joined the industry. And, you know, I came from another industry and it was very, very different. And my mentorship was basically somebody handed me like a printed packet that was a basically dictionary of market research terms. Mm-hmm. That was how I got through like my first year. Was like I would be in a meeting and I flip through the book, you know.
Totally.
What are they talking about here, right?
I totally know what you're talking about. I remember getting a giant packet as well, and it was just filled with acronyms.
That's it.
You know, the IR, the CPI, the LOI, the EPC. Like there's so many acronyms in our industry, and you know, it's all kind of muscle memory for you and I now, but for younger people, I'm sure it's pretty overwhelming. So having like someone that you can call on and ask questions of, and not just one, have multiple people in your network, even if it's more informal, like just say, listen, do you ever mind if I call you and reach out to you with questions? It just, I think provides that much added context and value for your own acumen as you build that up in the industry and over your career. It's super important. It'll make your life a lot easier and it'll make you more attractive as a potential hire for companies that are looking at you. So don't ever underestimate the power of a personal brand. I think that's really important as well.
For sure. And to your point, like, you know, as you ask more questions of people, now you've got relationships and you're more confident in your ideas and the new things that you can bring to the industry. Cause you know, that's one thing I really love about this industry is in the time that I've been here, it's changed so much. It just constantly feels like we're in this sort of state of rapid movement and evolution. And a lot of that comes from not necessarily just young people, but people coming to, like you said, from outside the industry into market research with different viewpoints. And that's really exciting. But you know, now with technology as it is, we're way more connected than we used to be when we were only in offices and could only call people on the phone, right? Now it's just, it's like an infinite network of people to lean on and to ask questions of. And there's so many resources. There's so many, you know, Zoom groups and lunches and events you can join and mentorship programs. So there's a lot of opportunity to get connected.
Oh, I'm almost jealous a little bit. You know, I wish they'd started now versus 20 years ago, because it felt more challenging back then for sure. But nowadays we're hyper connected, and there's people that I've had relationships with online over LinkedIn, and you know, we're like friends, but we've never met in person. And then when it like over, just over the summer, I was at Quirks and I had the opportunity to meet James Endersby for the first time in person. But like, I felt like I knew him because we had connected or, you know, over Zoom and over LinkedIn and we're sort of cheerleading and supporting each other. And so, you know, that's just one example of a bunch more. So it's just been a lot of fun kind of really harnessing all the value that the current market really allows us to do. And all these great resources on online allow us to do. So there's really, there's no excuse. You should get involved. It, like I said, it benefits your career growth. And it's just great to meet all these wonderful human beings that work in our industry. I think our industry is just like amazing. We've got some really cool people in it for sure. Really smart, sharp researchers. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's a good place to be. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show today, a day before the close of the SMR Council vote. So everybody, please get your votes in before tomorrow. Thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
Oh, likewise, Jen. I really appreciate you having me on the show. I've been an avid listener for a long time. So finally, so excited to be here. And I'll look forward to seeing you in a couple of days at the CRC.
Yes, I will see you at CRC and hopefully see a lot of the rest of you there as well. Thanks for listening in today. We have a special episode, episode 100 on Wednesday, and we have a huge announcement. So please make sure you tune in. See you then.